We're doing in Yaakov, we're up to Chav Zayin Amud Beis in the Standard Editions, which is Tractate Shabbos Daf Nun Vav. And we had been discussing King Solomon, and Talmud had told us that Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, was actually not as bad as the verses indicate. And the verses tell us that he actually worshipped pagan gods. The Talmud says what it means is that when his wives erected altars in honor of pagan gods, he didn't protest the way he should have, and that's why it's considered as though he did. We quoted from Rashi in Tractate Sota that when the verse says Ma'aleh of Hakosuv, the verse considers it as though. The verse is sometimes indicating that that's how severe the punishment was. So King Solomon was held accountable very highly for his wife's actions. And that's where we're up to. We're in the middle of that. Yes?
Just on a side note, I was hearing two sides about, you know, his wife's worshipping idols. And then I also heard that it's improper to say that any of his wives did not do a proper conversion.
We discussed two opinions on that from Tractate Gittin. We discussed that in Monday's in Yaakov class. About whether his wives did convert, didn't convert, did good conversions, not. We didn't go into Maimonides that says that they did do kosher conversions. We didn't go into that. Because it's a side note. It's not really our topic here. Tov, we're continuing. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel, the great disciple of Shmuel, said in the name of his Rebbe Shmuel. Shmuel was the disciple of Rebbe. He was a master doctor. He was Rav Yehuda Anasi's doctor. He was also a master astronomer. It says he knew the skies the way he knew the back alleys of his city. He knew everything perfectly. This is Shmuel, the regular Shmuel, also called Shmuel Hayarchi. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Noach lo l'oto tzadik, sheyeh shamash ledavar acher, v'leikatev bo v'yasara b'nei Hashem. That tzadik, Shlomo, would have preferred to act in the service of cutting wood and drawing water for a church, rather than have this verse written forever that he did that which was evil in the eyes of Hashem. The verse seems to say that's what he did, but you see, that was part of his punishment. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, B'sha'a shenasa Shlomot bat paro, when King Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh, hechnisa lo elef minei zemer. We did this. This is where we left off, right? She brought in 1,000 types of music. V'amra lo, and she said to him, kach osin l'avdat kochvin ploni, v'kach osin l'avdat kochvin ploni. This music is used in idol worship of this idol. This is used in idol worship of that idol. V'lo michaba. And he did not protest. Now, here we really have another topic, and that is the question of music. Shlomo HaMelech should have protested that she's bringing in the music. So some of the commentaries say she brought it in as part of the pagan ways she was bringing into his house. The question is that the interpretation? And this has a little bit of halachic relevance. I remember I was once in shul, and it was a little bit later in the year, and one of the chazanim decided to do kedusha to the tune of Jingle Bells. It says in the laws of Chazanim that you cannot appoint a Chazan who is accustomed to singing pagan songs. It says that. And here we run into a discussion of what's called pagan songs. You know, there's a discussion of where our tune of Moz Tzur comes from. It's difficult. I'm saying... you know, they sing the song, there are a lot of songs that we sing that we don't even realize their source is not Jewish.
In this generation a lot, I remember in Kansas, for Sukkot Torah, they would often for a Musaf, they would do Kedusha to the tunes from the Wizard of Oz.
Okay, so... we have traditional tunes, and then we have new tunes. There's the Rambam we once discussed. The Rambam in his commentary on Pirkei Avot, where the Rambam writes that a song is not kosher or lack thereof based on whether it's written in Hebrew or not. A song is considered kosher depending on what the content of the words are. If a non-Jew writes a song about good things, about being a good, kind person, so that's a good song. And if a Jew writes a song that's all about love and all kinds of... the whole point of the song is to arouse a person, so then that's not a good song. And it doesn't matter whether it was written in Hebrew or written by a Jew or not. That's the direction the Rambam goes. But that's a little bit different than our discussion. We're discussing songs that are used in idol worship. And again, the halacha says that someone who's accustomed to singing those songs should not be a chazan. So we do have that direction of thought. And again, our Gemara, even though it could be a source in this halachic discussion, the commentaries generally understand that she brought them into his house together with the idol worship, as an adjunct to the idol worship. And that's why it was so severe. So that's why our Gemara would not necessarily pose a source for this subject. Yes?
On the one end of the subject where it says that she's just bringing the music in a sense, do you think that it could be a little bit radical? Because personally, maybe he could have just been listening to it and learning from it to understand what is and what isn't. I'm trying to defend
So it. What you're saying, it actually says, the Gemara in Tractate Shabbos says, Lo sil midun, it says about different types of sorcery, you're not allowed to learn them. And the Talmud says, Lo til midun la'asot, you're not allowed to learn them in order to perform them. But you are allowed to learn them in order to give halachic ruling about them. Because part of what the courts have to rule on is, we have many prohibitions in the Torah about sorcery and idol worship. So how do you know if what the person did falls under that heading or not? So it says that the rabbis would actually go to the sorcerers and learn from them. They'd learn from them what they did in order to be able to rule halachically about whether this is considered idol worship or not. Today we have relevance to this question as well. In India, there's a tremendous trade of hair. Women shave their hair, and it's a part of a procession they do in front of an idol. The question is, what's their intention when they do that? Is this a part of the idol worship? Or is it that the person has to cleanse himself of his hair and then they can approach the idol? They actually do it outside the temple. They shave their head. And the relevance is that a lot of the wigs that are made, the hair is bought from there. Now it's a multi-million dollar business. I'm saying, you figure every shetel costs around $3,000-$4,000. The average seller has, let's say, on stock, 60, 70. That's already $250,000, the average seller, right? So it's a big industry. And we have a hard time verifying practically what they're doing when they shave their head, because now they know all the right answers, right? They realize why we're asking the question. So I'm saying there is halachic relevance to understanding some of the pagan ways for our own halachic ruling. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel. We continue. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, B'sha'ash nasa Shlomot bat Paro, when King Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter, Yerad Gabriel v'na'atz kaneh v'yam. The angel Gabriel, who's the angel that fights on our behalf, he went down to the sea, and he stuck in a reed, some kind of stick, a big stick, and that stick started collecting debris. And that debris ultimately became an island. And that island became one of the great cities of Rome. Our tradition is that he's talking about Greece. That Greece collected around that debris. No, nope. He's talking about Yavan, Greece. Which ultimately became a Roman city. The Braisa says that when Yeravam erected the two golden calves for the Jewish people to worship, when he broke away from the Davidic dynasty, developed his own kingdom in the north, so he erected two idols. So then at that time, a little hut was built, which ultimately became the great city of Italy. that the city of Italy started developing as a product of the idol worship that was going on in Israel. When we started idol worship here, that's when they started developing, that's when a hut was built, which ultimately became a community, which ultimately became a city, the city of Italy. Yes?
City of Italy?
Yeah.
Country?
Their Italia shel Yavan, I don't think, was the country. There's in Greece, there was a city called Italia.
Because when you said Yavan, I don't know if I'm just like making things too complicated, but in the 70 sons of Noah, there already was a son named Yavan who had a nation.
Right. Right. But the fact that there was a people, if those people ended up on that island, so he's saying that island got there then. More than that, I don't know. I'm saying you're right that there was a people called Yevanim long before that. That's true. But I don't know. I don't know. The idea that the first Medrash was Italia shel Yavan was also the first Medrash, that big city that became the island was Italia shel Yavan. I assume that's the Greek island, but you're right, maybe it's not. I don't know. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rav Yonatan. We have a quote from Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani in the name Rav Yonatan. Kol Omer Yoshiyahu Chatai No Ela Tohe. We have about Yoshiyahu. We'll see the verses in a minute. It says, Yoshiyahu did a tremendous tshuva. He repented. So that certainly sounds like he did something wrong. No, Rav Yonatan says, if you think he did something wrong, it's a mistake. Because the verse says, he did what was right in the eyes of Hashem. He went in the path of King David, his father. So then why does the verse say he did the greatest tshuva in history, in the history of the kings? What tshuva did he did? If he didn't do anything wrong, so what's the tshuva? The Gemara says, shekol din shedan mi ben shmona at shmona esrei chziran lehem. He became king at age 8, Yoshio. And he had to give ruling. And when he became 18, he suddenly looked back at all the rulings he had made as a judge, as a king from age 8. And he said, hey, maybe I was wrong. And he started paying back all the rulings. He looked back over all the books and paid back everyone who he had ruled against since he was 8, from 8 to 18. So that's the tshuva he did. Shema natan mizev natan lezeh. He said, maybe I made a mistake and I gave the wrong person. He had to rule when there were court cases. One of the king's jobs was to rule in monetary matters. And when he ruled, he said, maybe I got it wrong. So he started paying everyone back. You'd think maybe he took back from people the money he paid them. No. Talmud Lomar, b'chol modosh, natan lehem shlo. He paid out of pocket. So in halacha, we have a discussion. Does a person have to do tshuva for what they did as a minor? This is discussed in the very end of Hilchos Shabbos. We have a discussion at the very end of Hilchot Shabbat, what our responsibility is with regards to minors. You know, on Shabbos you have to watch your kid. We say it in Kiddush, right? Ata ubincha, you and your son. So we have to teach our children not to turn on lights on Shabbos, and once the child becomes of chinuch age, right? Our two-year-old turned on the light on Shabbos, and we said, that's not allowed. And she said, oh, so she turned the back off. Right? Okay. There's an age where they don't understand. You'll see the kids will sometimes turn on a light and you'll say it's Shabbos and they'll say no, not now. Say that. They don't yet understand. That's fine. The chinuch begins at an age where the kid can understand something. So by Shabbos it's biblical. On Shabbos we have a responsibility that our children should keep Shabbos. People make a mistake in this. They leave the line and say, oh, the kid will turn it off. They bring the kid and they say, okay, you want to turn that off, right? So we're not supposed to do that. I'm saying once the kid is old enough that they understand Shabbos, we're not supposed to have them desecrate Shabbos. So over there in that halacha, we have a discussion. Does a person have to do tshuva for what they did as a minor? And the answer is no. And, sometimes you'll remember as a kid, you were at the checkout aisle and you grabbed a candy bar. You don't have to do tshuva for it. It's person, our parents have to keep an eye on it, and the stores have to keep an eye on it, but we don't have to do tshuva. And even, people sometimes when they're kids, they cause monetary damage to people. So the rabbis made an institution that when our parents are aware of it, they do have to pay. That's to maintain the peace. Because if you didn't do that, then people might end up killing one another, you know. But the kid isn't obligated. Meaning when the kid becomes an adult, it's a level of piety if he remembers that he stole from someone and he pays it back. But they're not obligated. So what Yoshio did over here is tremendous. But we have to discern between two levels. Bein Adam LaChavero, our courts don't obligate a person until they're old enough to understand. Usually we say when a child becomes 13, that's when they're old enough. Now, sometimes in monetary matters, we have a concept of a kid who understands what he's dealing. Meaning there is such a concept in halacha. Sometimes a kid becomes an orphan. Sometimes a kid is a really good businessman, even though he's young. So there is such a discussion in halacha. But that's all in our courts. You can't judge a child. But we know that in heaven, a person is judged based upon their intellect. And the heavenly courts, generally we say you have to reach the intellect of a 20-year-old before you're held accountable for things that you do, that heaven takes you an accounting for. But that's the intellect level of a 20-year-old. So someone who's very smart, like Yehuda's children, Er and Onan, we will learn in a few weeks about how they married Tamar, and then they behaved improperly in the marriage. And so they died. It says Hashem killed them. And ordinarily we say if children die, it's because of their parents' transgressions, not their own. So why is it by Er and Onan, Yehuda's children, that they died young? They were minors. They were 8 years old. So from there, the Tosfos derives, we see that in the heavenly court, a person is judged based on their intellect level, not just based on their age. And so Yehuda's two children were old enough to get married, they had the intellect level that they were judged by the heavenly court based on their own merits or lack thereof. Yes?
I remember hearing in a midrash that you said that Cain and Hevel were born at the age of 15.
15, not 25?
Might be remembering wrong.
I think it's in Avos Rabbi Nassan, and it's either 20 or 25, I think it says. I don't think 15, but it could be I'm remembering wrong, I don't know. I have to look. And this opinion of Rav Yonasan is in discord with the opinion of Rav. Damar Rav had taught, En lecha gadol bebalei tshuva yitom Yoshiyahu. The greatest Baal Tshuva was Yoshio and his generation. Ve'acher bedoreinu, and someone else in our generation who's also a tremendous Baal Tshuva. And who is that? Abba Avua de Rabbi Yirmiya Bar Abba. The father of the father of Rabbi Yirmiya Bar Abba. Okay, so Rabbi Yirmiya's father's name was Abba. And his grandfather's name was
Abba.
Okay, so he was Abba ben Abba. Now, this sounds funny, but we find it in other places in Talmud. There were many people named Abba in Chas. Rava's real name was Abba. Rabba's real name was Abba. Rav's real name was Abba. Shmuel's father's name was Abba. Shmuel's grandfather's name was Abba. So the name Abba, it was a very common name in those days. I have no idea why. The Talmud says, "Ein korin avot ela shlosha." It's a Tosefta in Tractate Brachos. We only call Abba to three, your own biological father, and Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov. We don't say, I'm a descendant of Levi, so Abba Levi. But Levi's my great-great-great-grandfather. No. To be one of the patriarchs, to be one of the avot, you have to be Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov. That's it. It ends there. Even if you know you're a descendant of Levi, like you're a Kohen or a Levite. That's what the Talmud says in Tractate Brachos. The Talmud says that in those days, you wanted to say Mr. You wanted to give someone a term of respect. You used to say Abba. Abba Chaim. Abba Avram. Abba Shmuel. It was a term of respect. It says, servants, you shouldn't call them that, because someone might think he's actually your father. So the word Abba is Aramaic. In Hebrew, you have Av, you don't have Abba. Abba is Aramaic. But why they use this as names, I have no idea. So here we have Rabbi Yirmiya's father and grandfather, just like Shmuel's father and grandfather, was called Abba. And others say it was Acha, the brother of Abba, Rav Yirmiyah's uncle. These two, Acha and Abba, brother and father, okay, interesting names. Their father called one of them Abba. Well, their father's name was Abba. So he named one of his kids Abba and one of his kids Acha. Okay? They were brothers. So these two were tremendous Baalei Tshuva, and the Talmud doesn't tell us what they did. Doesn't tell us what was their great Tshuva. Amar Rav Yosef Vodechad Bidoreinu. Rav Yosef says, in our generation, we also have a great Baal Tshuva. Who is that? Ukvan Bar Nachman Reish Galuta. Ukvan Bar Nachman, the head of the exile. The Hainu Natan Titzutzita. And that is the famous Natan who has a shine. Who is Natan Titzutzita? So the Talmud doesn't tell us. Now the problem is that Natan Titzutzita shows up in Rav Nissim Gaon's writings as living in the generation of Rabbi Akiva. And here he's in the generation of Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef is 200 years after Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Akiva is post-temple. He's a disciple of Rabbi Yeshua, right? The time of Bar Kochva. Rav Yosef is a late generation Amora. So it's not clear to me who this Natan Titzutzita is. It says, okay, I'll tell you the full story in a minute. Let's just finish this chapter. Rav Yosef says, Ave yativna bepirka vekamenamnem vechazai bechelma dekapashet yadei vekiblei. Says, I was learning, and I dozed off. And as I dozed off, I saw that an angel extended his hand and accepted him betshuva. So we see there's this concept of accepting a person's tshuva. There's a concept of doing tshuva, and there's a concept of the tshuva being accepted, which is logical, right? A person has to reach a certain level that in heaven they accept his tshuva. You say you're sorry, you have to reach a level that someone accepts it. It's not just enough to have just done the motions. And with that, we end the fifth chapter of Shamus. I'm going to divide this and the next story into two recordings, because the next story is not fit for kids.